Counsel will call the next witness.
Mr. Robert C. Mardian, will you please come to the witness table?
Robert Mardian, the next witness to appear before the committee, was the former Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Internal Security Division and was also a political coordinator for the Nixon Re-Election Committee.
Do you swear that the evidence that you shall give to the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Would you please state your name and your residence for the record?
My name is Robert C. Mardian. My address is 2323 North Central Avenue, Phoenix, Arizona.
Now, I observe that you're accompanied by counsel. Will counsel please identify himself for the purpose of the record?
My name is David Bress. I'm a lawyer in Washington, D.C.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. James Hamilton, Assistant Chief Counsel, that will ask the question to this witness.
Mr. Bress, I understand that you have a brief statement that you want to make before you begin.
Yes, Mr. Hamilton. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mardian has conferred on two occasions with the United States Attorney's Office in May 1973 before his appearance before the grand jury on May 7th. In those conferences and grand jury appearance, Mr. Mardian at no time asserted any constitutional privilege he might have, and he asserts none today. He did, however, on my advice, assert the attorney-client privilege insofar as questions related to conversations he had with Mr. Liddy on June 21, 1972. But as to all other attorney-client communications with other persons, no privilege was asserted because we were satisfied that such other persons had waived the privilege. Accordingly, by pre-arrangement with the United States Attorney's Office, when questions were propounded before the grand jury relating to his communications with Mr. Liddy, all counsel proceeded to Judge Sirica's court on the same day and argued the matter. After taking it under advisement, the court ordered the questions to be answered, and this was done. Later, Mr. Mardian spent 2 days conferring with the staff of this committee on June 1 and July 14, 1973. All questions were fully answered, and he now stands ready to answer any further questions after he makes a short introductory statement, a copy of which has been furnished to the staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I ask a question to make sure I fully understand the burden of counsel's statement? Is it insisted that there is an existing extant attorney-client privilege between the witness and Mr. Liddy on the occasion described that is advanced today?
No, sir. I have made the point that the attorney-client privilege was asserted, but that we feel bound by the determination on that question by Judge Sirica on May the 7th, the day when he appeared before the grand jury, and we will comply with that ruling so that no privilege on the attorney-client basis is being asserted today in any form.
Thank you.
You may read the statement.
Thank you. I was born in Pasadena, California, October 23rd, 1923, and I graduated from law school in 1949. From that time to 1969, except for my involvement in my family business in Phoenix, Arizona, I was engaged exclusively in the practice of law, either in private practice or as general counsel from 1962 to 1969 for a financial institution. In 1969, I was appointed general counsel for the United States Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which title I held until September 1970. During the period commencing January 1970 until November 1970, I was also the executive director of the Cabinet Committee on Education, which was charged with the responsibility of implementing the administration's school desegregation policies, principally in the southern states. From November 1970 until May of 1972, I was Assistant Attorney General, Internal Security Division, Department of Justice. Commencing May 1, 1972, until the election, I was employed at the committee to re-elect the president. On November 10, 1972, we moved from Washington, D.C., and we have since that time resided in Phoenix, Arizona, where I have been engaged in business with my three brothers. Almost from the beginning of my tenure at the Justice Department, there were rumors in the press and other public media that the Attorney General, John Mitchell, would leave the Department of Justice sometime in 1971 to head the 1972 presidential campaign. There were also rumors, starting in the fall of 1971, that I would be leaving the Justice Department to assist Mr. Mitchell in the campaign effort. I do not recall discussing with Mr. Mitchell his intentions regarding the campaign until the fall of 1971. As best as I can recall, he told me that it had not been finally decided whether or not he would be heading the campaign effort. I cannot recall discussing my possible involvement in the campaign with him until sometime in January 1972. I had agreed with my wife prior to that time to leave the administration at the end of the president's first term. In anticipation of this, we took advantage of an opportunity to sell our home in McLean, Virginia, and in January 1972, we moved into an apartment in Washington. Although I had never discussed with Mr. Mitchell my specific role in the campaign, I agreed in February of 1972 to accept Mr. Mitchell's invitation to join the campaign organization, which I did on May 1, 1972. I was, as has been testified to, appointed originally as a campaign coordinator. But with respect to the events which are the subject of this committee's inquiry, I should point out that I had not, in my capacity as one of the political coordinators or otherwise, been consulted, advised, or favored with any information relating to the Dirty Tricks campaign, which has now come to light, much less given a hint of any proposed burglary or electronic surveillance. I was not included in the inner circles of knowledge. My help was needed as a lawyer. And if I make no other point in this brief prefatory statement, I would like it in the record that as of the morning of June 17, 1972, I was relieved of my political responsibilities to the extent possible and charged with the responsibility of acting as counsel to the committee, at least as far as the Watergate was concerned. I accepted this responsibility with the understanding that I would obtain the assistance of independent legal counsel and that I would be relieved of this legal responsibility when they were sufficiently acquainted with the facts to handle the matter. I should also like to make it clear that I was and probably still am one of the attorneys of record in the litigation pending between the Democratic National Committee and the Committee to Re-elect the President and others. It was as a lawyer and not as a political associate that those persons confided in me, and this was made clear to me not by implication but by express statement, and that it was as a lawyer and not as a political protege that I agreed to maintain the fiduciary obligation not to disclose that which was confided in me. If this be the basis of the broad brush charge of cover-up, then it is a charge that every lawyer must answer under our adversary system of criminal justice, a system that requires a lawyer to respect the confidence of his client until waived by the client, no matter how helpful it might be to the lawyer to disclose. I adhered to this principle in seeking a court ruling on the attorney-client privilege before testifying in May before the grand jury. In light of the court's ruling and the waivers resulting from the testimony of others, I feel no constraints now and can fully discuss the facts with which I am familiar without causing the public or the bar to feel that I have not fully adhered to the duty of a lawyer to respect his client's confidence. I would also like to say at this point that the information that I received on the morning of June 17 and June 21 was the most shocking experience in my entire legal career. The facts thus learned thrust me into a situation which I can only compare in terms of personal anxiety to being caught in quicksand. Commencing the morning of June 17, 1972, information was imparted to me bit by bit, much of it contradictory, which drew me inexorably into an intolerable and at times unbearable situation of personal conscience, a situation in which I was precluded from acting according to the dictates of my personal desires or interest, a situation in which ultimately my only hope was the selfish one of not becoming implicated in the conduct of others who I felt it my duty to serve. I am not at all sure of the exact sequence of events for all of the times, the places, and the parties present, but I shall attempt to relate as fairly and as candidly as I can the history of the Watergate as I learned it. That concludes my statement. I'm prepared to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mardian. Now, you stated in your statement that you are now engaged in a family business.
Yes, sir.
And I wish you would identify what business this is for the record and state your position with this business.
The business is Mardian Construction Company, and I'm a vice president of Mardian Construction Company.
And is that in Phoenix?
Yes, sir.
Now, by way of background, Mr. Mardian, did you participate in the presidential campaign of 1968?
Yes,
Mr. Nixon's behalf.
Yes, sir.
And what duties did you have in this campaign?
I was the Western Regional Director for the campaign and had the responsibility for liaison in the Western states.
And how many states did that entail, Mr. Mardian?
It varied. Originally it was 6, and I believe later it was 12.
Now, after the election, as you have testified, you joined the new administration.
Yes, sir.
Now, you've already given us your government positions and your tenure in each, so I don't want to dwell on that. But I do want to ask you several questions about your government experience. Now, while you were heading the Internal Security Division, did you have responsibility for the prosecution of the criminal case against Dr. Ellsberg?
Yes, I did.
And were you also given in the spring of 1972 the task of guiding the Kleindienst nomination through the Senate?
Yes, sir.
During your government experience, did you work closely with John Mitchell?
Yes, sir.
And do you still maintain a close relationship with John Mitchell?
My relationship was a close professional, personal relationship. I have not maintained, I still consider him my friend, but I have not talked to Mr. Mitchell or seen Mr. Mitchell since the inaugural. I believe I talked to him on the telephone at or about that time in connection with an appointment.
Now, I believe in your statement, you testified that on the 1st of May, you joined the reelection committee. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And did you come to the reelection committee at John Mitchell's behest?
Yes, sir.
Now, accepting any functions that you later received in regard to the Watergate matters, could you tell us what your major duties were at the committee to reelect the president? And would you also tell us what the official titles of your positions were?
When I first got there, the situation was in a, I can only describe it as a state of confusion. I had no title. I had assumed, and I think in fairness I should say that this assumption was purely subjective on my part, that I was going to the committee to be Mr. Mitchell's deputy. When I got there, there wasn't even an office for me, and it wasn't until, I don't know when it was in the point of time, that a memorandum was sent to me indicating that I, along with four other people, would be appointed as political coordinators.
Did you maintain the position of political coordinator during your entire stay at the committee, or did you subsequently have a change in title?
I believe after, it may have been after the convention, I'm not sure, it may have been after Mr. McGregor came over, I was, I believe, named a special assistant or assistant to the campaign director. I'm not quite sure on the timing of that.
Could you give us, in a nutshell, your duties in regard to the campaign, excluding, as I said before, those that you took on in regard to Watergate?
As I've tried to indicate, there were organizational problems at the committee when I got there, and the title campaign coordinator was never really defined for me. I devoted most of my time in the 5 or 6 weeks before Watergate to primarily the political organizations in the western states, much the same as I had done in 68.
Mr. Martin, you said in your statement that you had no knowledge of the plans and activities that led to the break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters on the 17th of June. Did you, prior to June 17th, 1972, have knowledge of any covert intelligence plans or operations that had as their purpose the gathering of information for political purposes?
None whatsoever, and I have been involved in numerous campaigns, and it's the first time I've ever heard of this type of activity in a campaign. It may have gone on, but I never was aware of it.
When did you first learn of the break-in at the Democratic headquarters?
On the morning of June 17th.
And where were you at that time?
I was at the Air Porter Hotel in Inglewood, California.
Would you please relate to the committee in some detail how you were first informed of the break-in and what details you were told at that time?
I had made arrangements to have Mr. Mitchell meet with the party people and the CRP people in California. It was a large meeting scheduled, the initial meeting at 11 o'clock that morning, with a joint meeting of the various county chairmen from the two organizations, the regular party organization and the CRP. We were on our way to the hotel, from one hotel to the other. We were following a limousine in which Mr. Mitchell and Governor Reagan were riding. And present with me were the national committeemen from California, Mr. Magruder and Mr. LaRue. And Mr. Magruder told me in the car on the way to the airporter that he had a slight PR problem he wished to discuss with me. I suggested to Mr. Magruder that if it was a PR problem, that he was better able to handle it than I was. I had arranged the meeting, and I knew most of the people there, and Mr. Mitchell didn't. He told me that it was a PR problem that required a lawyer. I attempted to elicit from him in the car what it was, and he indicated, I believe more by gesture, that he could not speak in the presence of the national committeeman from California. When we arrived at the Air Porter Hotel, and I believe it was around 11 o'clock or sometime a few minutes before, Mr. Magruder detained me and said that it was essential that he brief me on his PR problem, and that Mr. Mitchell had told him to tell me to forget the meeting until I got the information he was to impart to me. I don't know for sure where this briefing took place. I've heard the testimony of witnesses, and it's hard to remember what I've heard here and what occurred, but to the best of my recollection, we went to a banquet room immediately adjoining the large meeting room where the political meeting was to take place. I thought that Mr. LaRue was with us. I heard his testimony this morning, which would indicate that possibly he wasn't. My recollection is that Mr. LaRue was present when Mr. Magruder briefed me. He told me that he had had a call. And again, my recollection originally was that it was from Mr. Odell. It's now that it was from Mr. Liddy. Mr. Odell did call me about the Watergate subsequently. That he'd had this call from Mr. Liddy and had been informed that Mr. McCord, who was a security officer for the committee, along with five Cuban Americans, maybe four, I'm not sure, had been arrested in a break-in of the Democratic National Committee headquarters. He told me that the people arrested had all had fake ID cards, which Mr. Hunt had procured for them from the CIA, and that although they were incarcerated, the identities of the accused was not known. He told me that, I guess in response to my question of how and why, he told me that Mr. Liddy was some kind of a nut. He should have suspected that something like this would happen. He regretted that he had not insisted on firing him when he attempted to some weeks or months before.
WBAI New York.
I believe there was more that he told me, and that it's difficult to recall extemporaneously now. Oh, I believe that came later. I've given testimony to the staff, and on two occasions I may have left something out.
Well, Mr. Martin, did it come a time later that afternoon when you had a further discussion with Mr. Mitchell and Mr. LaRue, Mr. Magruder and Mr. LaRue, as to the details of the events surrounding the break-in?
Counsel has just reminded me there was one other thing that I was informed of at that time, and that was that this was... I'm sorry, may I...
If you'd like to answer my previous question, go ahead. In other words, about your first information.
He also told me, I believe, that this was not the first break-in of the Democratic National Headquarters.
Did Mr. Magruder tell you the source of his information that this was not the first break-in?
Mr. Liddy.
Now, did there come a time later that afternoon when you had a further discussion on the events surrounding the break-in with Mr. Mitchell and Magruder and LaRue?
Yes, and here again, when we say Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Magruder, and Mr. LaRue, I can't say for sure that all parties were present at all times. I do recall a discussion with these gentlemen, or some of them.
What further facts did you learn in this discussion?
I don't know when I learned it, but I learned it soon after we left the airport. As I recall, there were a series of meetings starting at 11 and ending, my memory in this regard is based solely on the schedule, which a copy of which you, your staff furnished me, or the U.S. attorneys furnished me. Mr. Mitchell, the last event on the schedule was a press conference at 1:30, and I believe that press conference must have lasted a half an hour or so, and assuming we got back to the Beverly Hills Hotel at 2:30 or thereabouts, I would guess, maybe 2:45, quarter to 3, 2:45, I'm not quite sure. I learned soon after we got back, it could have been in the car, but I would doubt it since there was a driver who was a stranger, it was a hired car, hired limousine, that the purpose, one of the purposes of the break-in was to fix a bug that had been previously placed in the Democratic National Headquarters that wasn't working. I don't recall any more input on the break-in as of that time.
Well, was there a discussion that afternoon about a budget that had been approved for dirty tricks and black advance?
Yes, I believe that that was told to me by Mr. Magruder at the airport or hotel, and in other words, during that briefing, one of the items I think he told me there. I'm not certain of the sequence of events, but I believe that was the time.
Now, Mr. Morton, I think after 2 months we know what dirty tricks refers to, but could you just explain the term black advance?
I'll attempt to the best I can. I'd never heard the expression before, and I assumed when they told me about it that it was for black advance men. I learned, however, that a black advance was a counter advance that was carried on against the opposition candidates or persons acting on their behalf. In other words, an attempt to disrupt the advance schedule of the opposition.
Did Mr. Magruder inform you who had approved the budget for dirty tricks and black advance?
Yes.
And whom did he say?
He told me that the budget had been approved by Mr. Mitchell.
And did Mr. Mitchell later that afternoon confirm that he had approved such a budget?
I'd like to put it this way, it's my best recollection, that I think the subject was discussed and he didn't deny it.
Did Mr. Magruder or Mr. Mitchell?
Pardon me, but I'm trying to be eminently fair. I'm not positive that it was discussed, but I feel that it was, because I was trying to get at the facts. I didn't know the facts. I hadn't heard of black advance or dirty tricks, and it certainly must have come up in the discussion. And again, it may have come up when Mr. Mitchell wasn't in the room. I want to be fair on that point.
What is your best recollection as to whether Mr. Mitchell was in the room when that was discussed?
That is my best recollection. I'm trying to be fair, however. When you ask about meetings, and I've heard all types of meetings took place in Mr. Mitchell's office and other places. With respect to Mr. Mitchell's office, anytime anybody walked in the room, as I understand it, his secretary would log it, and that was a meeting. Sometimes you'd walk in to see that there was somebody else that was there and walk out, and you attended a meeting. And I hate to characterize a formal meeting where he sat down and admitted that he had approved a black advance budget. That's my best recollection, that he was present and that I discussed it.
And counsel, excuse me for interjecting this remark at this time. I don't know any way that any human being can testify as to a past event except by giving his best recollection.
Thank you.
Mr. Mardian, while in California, did you receive an assignment from Mr. Mitchell regarding the Watergate matter?
Could you be more specific?
All right. Did Mr. Mitchell assign you to deal with the legal matters that might arise in connection with the break-in?
Yes.
And Mr. Mardian, while in California, did you make several telephone calls to Mr. Liddy?
I believe that my records show that, which I have turned over to the committee, and these are records of calls that I turned in to the committee to re-elect the president, that I talked to Mr. Liddy on three occasions. The records show three, and there were three, but one of the ones the record shows was not a call to Mr. Liddy, as I recall.
Do you remember when these calls took place? On Saturday or Sunday?
The first time I talked to Lister Liddy, I believe, was on Saturday, and that was not a call from me to him, but a call from him to me, as I recall. It's possible I may have returned the call, but that's my best recollection.
Did you also talk to Mr. Liddy on Sunday?
I talked to Mr. Liddy on Sunday twice, as I recall.
Now, can you give us the best recollection you have of the substance of these three telephone calls?
The first telephone call was as I recall, was an urgent demand on the part of Mr. Liddy that I return to Washington. He had indicated in that call, as I understand it, that Mr. Magruder was going to return. He did not want Mr. Magruder to return. He wanted me to return. He was very reluctant to, not only reluctant, he refused to use the telephone to discuss anything about Watergate. He did, however, make some derogatory remarks about Mr. Magruder. That's all I recall about the first telephone call.
Would you go on to the second and the third, please?
I had told Mr. Liddy that about the plans that I heard that Mr. Magruder was going to return. I would communicate with Mr. Mitchell, and I would let him know.
And the final telephone call?
Well, that was the first telephone call. The second telephone call, as I recall, was when I called to tell him that I was not going to return and that Mr. Magruder had returned.
And what was the final telephone call?
Final telephone call was with respect to a call I got from Powell Moore. Powell Moore called me on Sunday. I previously testified that these conversations originally that they were Sunday. I was told that they were on Saturday. I wasn't sure. I have now checking the records of the calls that these calls took place on Sunday. Powell Moore called me to tell me of an occurrence the previous day. He said that he wanted me to know, for Mr. Mitchell to know, that Mr. Liddy had told him in his presence that he had received a call from Mr. Mitchell, that Mr. Mitchell had instructed him to go see Mr. Kleindienst and to have Mr. Kleindienst get the Watergate burglars released from jail. He told me that he did not believe that these instructions came from Mr. Mitchell. He told Mr. Liddy that he should not contact Mr. Kleindienst, that when he realized that he was in fact going to contact Mr. Kleindienst, he went with him. That Mr. Liddy made contact with Mr. Kleindienst at the Burning Tree Country Club, and that in order to advise Mr. Kleindienst that he was not to pay any attention to Mr. Liddy, he said he stood behind Mr. Liddy so that Mr. Liddy could not see him, but that Mr. Kleindienst could, and shook his head violently as he could so that Mr. Kleindienst would know that what he was telling him was an untruth. He told me that Mr. Kleindienst, in effect, had told Mr. Liddy to go to hell. And as I understood it, went on playing golf. I then called Mr. Kleindienst. I think I told Mr. Mitchell about it. Mr. Mitchell was amazed. I then called Mr. Kleindienst to tell him that Mr. Mitchell had given no such instructions. And Mr. Kleindienst was told me, I believe, that he was satisfied that he hadn't given any instructions and in effect said, keep that, use an adjective, away from me. I then called Mr. Liddy and reprimanded him. I told him that Mr. Mitchell had given no instructions and that he had done a very, committed a very embarrassing error on the part of the Attorney General.
Mr. Martin, I want to read to you a portion of Mr. Magruder's testimony that is found at page 1910 of the record. We knew that Mr. Mardian, who was there, was a closer friend of Mr. Liddy's than any one of us. And Mr. Mitchell asked Mr. Mardian to call Mr. Liddy and ask him to see the Attorney General, the current Attorney General, Mr. Kleindienst, and see if there was any possibility that Mr. McCord could be released from jail.
That statement is not true.
Mr. Martin, can you suggest any reason why Mr. Magruder would falsely testify as to such a phone call on your part?
I don't think Mr. Magruder would intentionally falsely testify. The subject of the Liddy trip to see Mr. Kleindienst was much discussed. Mr. Liddy's position, or the story that Powell Moore told, was that, as I recall, that John Mitchell had called Liddy. Here again, I can't fathom the reason that that's the way it came out in his memory. I think Mr. Liddy would be the one to answer that question. And I can't imagine why Mr. Magruder would say that I was a friend of Liddy's, or a close friend of Liddy's, whatever he used to describe it. I had not seen Mr. Liddy, to my knowledge, except possibly in the hallway or once or twice from the time I was at the committee. And I certainly wouldn't be classified as a friend of his by anybody that knows me.
Well, if Mr. Liddy did not act pursuant to a request from you by telephone, can you give us any help as to what prompted Mr. Liddy to make this visit to Mr. Kleindienst?
I can't help you on that. If you examine was asked, I was asked to call Liddy to see Kleindienst. Mr. Mitchell would have instructed me to call Kleindienst myself. I didn't need an intermediary for him. Mr. Kleindienst's a close friend of mine.
Mr. Mardian, when did you leave California to return to Washington?
We left on the morning of the 19th, I believe.
And when you arrived in Washington, where did you go?
I went home.
About what time did you arrive?
I've been unable to fix that. All I can recall, my wife's recollection, is that it was dusk, which would place it in the neighborhood of 8 o'clock or a little after.
Now, after arriving at home, did you go directly to Mr. Mitchell's apartment?
Yes. When I say directly, sure, I helped with the bags, and I was on the plane for 5 hours. I may have...
And do you know what time you arrived at Mr. Mitchell's apartment?
I have no recollection.
If you suspend for just a moment, there's a boat signal. There's a boat signal on the clock, and it's 12:20 now. The chairman is temporarily away from the table. I think this might be a good time to recess, and the committee will stand in recess until 2 o'clock.
So this morning, Frederick LaRue finished his testimony before the Senate Watergate Committee, and the next witness, the last witness you just heard, which was Robert Mardian, the former Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Internal Security Division. Mardian was also a political coordinator for the Nixon Re-Election Committee. Mardian will be back on the stand this afternoon in about an hour and 40 minutes or so. This morning, Mardian testified that he learned of the break-in on June 17. Immediately after it happened, he, along with Jeb Stuart Magruder and John Mitchell, was in California at the time. He was briefed by Magruder and was told that there had been a previous break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters, and that the purpose of that break-in, the first break-in, was to, the purpose of the second break-in was to repair a bug that was placed there during the first break-in. Mardian also testified that a budget approved for dirty tricks and what he called black advance was approved by, at least according to his recollection of the facts, was approved by John Mitchell. Pacifica Radio will continue its live coverage of these hearings by the Senate Watergate Committee in an hour and 40 minutes or so at 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. And until then, with David Lerner, this is David Selvin for Pacifica Radio in Washington.
You can fool some of the people, most all of the time, and you can fool all the people some of the time, but the same old truth is setting there in the middle of the slime.